Masterpieces of Mystery, Story 6, Sister Maddalena, by Ralph Adams Cram, Part 2. The stars were blotted out through nearly all the sky. Low, thunderous clouds, massed at the head of the valley, were sweeping over so close that they seemed to brush the black pines on the mountain above us. To the south and east, the storm clouds had shut down almost to the sea, leaving a space of black sky, where the moon in its last quarter was rising just to the left of Monte Pellegrino, a black silhouette against the pallid moonlight. The rosy lightning flashed almost incessantly, and through the fitful darkness came the sound of bells across the valley, the rushing torrent below, and the dull roar of the approaching rain, with a deep organ point of solemn thunder through it all. We fled indoors from the coming tempest, and taking our candles, said good night, and sought each his respective room. My own was in the southern part of the old convent, giving on the terrace we had just quitted, and about over the main doorway. The rushing storm, as it swept down the valley with the swelling torrent below, was very fascinating, and after wrapping myself in a dressing gown, I stood for some time by the deeply embrasured window, watching the blazing lightning and the beating rain whirled by fitful gusts of wind around the spurs of the mountains. Gradually the violence of the shower seemed to decrease. I threw myself down on my bed in the hot air, wondering if I really was to experience the ghostly visit the Cavalier so confidently predicted. I had thought out the whole matter to my own satisfaction, and fancied I knew exactly what I should do in case Sister Maddalena came to visit me. The story touched me. The thought of the poor faithful girl who sacrificed herself for her lover, himself very likely quite unworthy, and who now could never sleep, for reason of her unquiet soul, sent out into the storm of eternity without spiritual aid or counsel. I could not sleep, for the still vivid lightning, the crowding thoughts of the dead nun, and the shivering anticipation of my possible visitation, made slumber quite out of the question. No suspicion of sleepiness had visited me, when, perhaps an hour after midnight, came a sudden vivid flash of lightning. And as my dazzled eyes began to regain the power of sight, I saw her plainly as in life, a tall figure, shrouded in the white habit of the Carmelites, her head bent, her hand clasped before her. In another flash of lightning, she slowly raised her head and looked at me long and earnestly. She was very beautiful, like the Virgin of Beltraffio in the National Gallery, more beautiful than I had supposed possible. Her deep, passionate eyes, very tender and pitiful in their pleading, beseeching glance. I hardly thought I was frightened, or even startled, but lay looking steadily at her as she stood in the beating lightning. Then she breathed, rather than articulated, with a voice that almost brought tears, so infinitely sad and sorrowful was it.
"I cannot sleep."
And the liquid eyes grew more pitiful and questioning, as bright tears fell from them down the pale, dark face. The figure began to move slowly toward the door, its eyes fixed on mine with a look that was weary and almost agonized. I leaped from the bed and stood waiting. A look of utter gratitude swept over the face and, turning, the figure passed through the doorway. Out into the shadow of the corridor it moved, like a drift of pallid storm cloud, and I followed, all natural and instinctive fear or nervousness, quite blotted out by the part I felt I was to play in giving rest to a tortured soul. The corridors were velvet black, but the pale figure floated before me always, an unerring guide, now but a thin mist on the upper night, now white and clear in the bluish lightning, through some window or doorway. Down the stairway into the lower hall, across the refectory, where the great frescoed crucifixion flared into sudden clearness, under the fitful lightning, out into the silent cloister. It was very dark. I stumbled along the heavy bricks, now guiding myself by a hand on the whitewashed wall, now by a touch on a column wet with the storm. From all the eaves the rain was dripping onto the pebbles at the foot of the arcade. A pigeon, startled from the capital where it was sleeping, beat its way into the cloister close. Still the white thing drifted before me to the farther side of the court, then along the cloister at right angles, and paused before one of the many doorways that led to the cells. A sudden blaze of fierce lightning. The last now, the fleeting trail of storm, leaped around us, and in the vivid light I saw the white face turned again with the look of overwhelming desire, of beseeching pathos, that had choked my throat with an involuntary sob when I first saw Sister Maddalena. In the brief interval that ensued after the flash and before the roaring thunder burst like the crash of battle over the trembling convent, I heard again the sorrowful words, "I cannot sleep," come from the impenetrable darkness. And when the lightning came again, the white figure was gone. I wandered around the courtyard, searching in vain for Sister Maddalena, even until the moonlight broke through the torn and sweeping fringes of the storm. I tried the door where the white figure vanished. It was locked, but I had found what I sought, and carefully noting its location, went back to my room, but not to sleep. In the morning, the cavalier asked Rendell and me which of us had seen the ghost, and I told him my story. Then I asked him to grant me permission to sift the thing to the bottom, and he courteously gave the whole matter into my charge, promising that he would consent to anything. I could hardly wait to finish breakfast, but no sooner was this done than, forgetting my morning pipe, I started with Rendell and the cavalier to investigate. "I'm sure there is nothing in that cell," said Valguanera when he came in front of the door I had marked. "It is curious that you should have chosen the door of the very cell that tradition assigns to Sister Maddalena. But I have often examined that room myself, and I am sure that there is no chance for anything to be concealed. In fact, I had the floor taken up once, soon after I came here, knowing the room was that of the mysterious sister, and thinking that there, if anywhere, the monastic crime would have taken place. Still, we will go in, if you like." He unlocked the door, and we entered, one of us at all events, with a beating heart. The cell was very small, hardly 8 feet square. There certainly seemed no opportunity for concealing a body in the tiny place, and although I sounded the floor and walls, or gave a solid, heavy answer, the unmistakable sound of masonry. For the innocence of the floor, the cavalier answered. He had, he said, had it all removed, even to the curving surfaces of the vault below. Yet somewhere in this room, the body of the murdered girl was concealed. Of this, I was certain. But where? There seemed no answer, and I was compelled to give up the search for the moment, somewhat to the amusement of Valguanera, who had watched curiously, to see if I could solve the mystery. But I could not forget the subject, and toward noon started on another tour of investigation. I procured the keys from the cavalier and examined the cells adjoining. They were apparently the same, each with its window opposite the door, and nothing. Stay, were they the same? I hastened into the suspected cell. It was as I thought. This cell, being on a corner, could have had two windows, yet only one was visible, and that to the left, at right angles with the doorway. Was it imagination? As I sounded the wall opposite the door, where the other window should be, I fancied that the sound was a trifle less solid and dull. I was becoming excited. I dashed back to the cell on the right, and, forcing open the little window, thrust my head out. It was found at last. In the smooth surface of the yellow wall was a rough space, following approximately the shape of the other cell windows, not plastered like the rest of the wall, but showing the shapes of bricks through its thick coatings of whitewash. I turned with a gasp of excitement and satisfaction. Yes, the embouchure of the wall was deep enough. What a wall it was. 4 feet at least, and the opening of the window reached to the floor, though the window itself was hardly 3 feet square. I felt absolutely certain that the secret was solved, and called the cavalier and Rendell, too excited to give them an explanation of my theories. They must have thought me mad when I suddenly began scraping away at the solid wall in front of the door, but in a few minutes they understood what I was about, for under the coatings of paint and plaster appeared the original bricks, and as my architectural knowledge had led me rightly, the space I had cleared was directly over a vertical joint between firm, workmanlike masonry on one hand, and rough, amateurish work on the other, bricks laid anyway, and without order or science. Rendell seized a pick and was about to assail the rude wall when I stopped him. "Let us be careful," I said. "Who knows what we may find?" So he set to work digging out the mortar around a brick at about the level of our eyes. How hard the mortar had become. But a brick yielded at last, and with trembling fingers I detached it. Darkness within. Yet beyond question, there was a cavity there, not a solid wall. and with infinite care we removed another brick. Still, the hole was too small to admit enough light from the dimly illuminated cell. With a chisel, we pried at the sides of a large block of masonry, perhaps 8 bricks in size. It moved, and we softly slid it from its bed. Aguanera, who was standing watching as we lowered the bricks to the floor, gave a sudden cry, a cry like that of a frightened woman. Terrible, coming from him. Yet there was cause. Framed by the ragged opening of the bricks, hardly seen in the dim light, was a face, an ivory image, more beautiful than any antique bust, but drawn and distorted by unspeakable agony, the lively mouth half open, as though gasping for breath, the eyes cast upward, and below, slim, chiselled hands crossed on the breast, but clutching the folds of the white Carmelite habit, torture and agony visible in every tense muscle, fighting against the determination of the rigid pose. We stood there breathless, staring at the pitiful sight, fascinated, bewitched. So this was the secret. With fiendish ingenuity, the rigid ecclesiastics had blocked up the window, then forced the beautiful creature to stand in the alcove, while with remorseless hands and iron hearts, they had shut her into a living tomb. I'd read of such things in romance, but to find the verity here, before my eyes. Steps came down the cloister, and with a simultaneous thought, we sprang to the door and closed it behind us. The room was sacred. That awful sight was not for curious eyes. The gardener was coming to ask some trivial questions of Aguanera. The cavalier cut him short. Pietro, go down to Paco and ask Padre Stefano to come here at once. I thanked him with a glance. Stay, he turned to me. Signor, it is already 2 o'clock, and too late for mass, is it not? I nodded. Aguanera thought a moment. Then he said, bring 2 horses. The Signor Americano will go with you. Do you understand? Then turning to me, you will go, will you not? I think you can explain matters to Padre Stefano better than I.
Of course I will go, more than gladly.
So it happened that after a hasty luncheon, I wound down the mountain to Paco, found Padre Stefano, explained my errand to him, found him intensely eager and sympathetic, and by 5 o'clock had him back at the convent with all that was necessary for the resting of the soul of the dead girl. In the warm twilight, with the last light of the sunset pouring into the little cell through the window, where almost a century ago Rosalia had for the last time said farewell to her lover, we gathered together to speed her tortured soul on its journey, so long delayed. Nothing was omitted. All the needful offices of the church were said by Padre Stefano, while the light in the window died away, and the flickering flames of the candles carried by 2 of the acolytes from San Francisco threw fitful flashes of pallid light into the dark recess where the white face had prayed to heaven for 100 years. Finally, the padre took the asperge from the hands of one of the acolytes, and with a sign of the cross in benediction while he chanted the asperge, gently sprinkled the holy water on the upturned face. Instantly, the whole vision crumbled to dust. The face was gone, and where the candlelight had flickered and the perfect semblance of the girl dead so very long. It now fell only on the rough bricks which closed the window, bricks laid with frozen hearts by pitiless hands. But our task was not done yet. It had been arranged that Padre Stefano should remain at the convent all night, and that as soon as midnight made it possible, we should say the first mass for the repose of the girl's soul. We sat on the terrace, talking over the strange events of the last crowded hours, and I noted with satisfaction that the cavalier no longer spoke of the church with that hardness which had hurt me so often. It is true that the padre was with us nearly all the time, but not only was Valguanera courteous, he was also sympathetic, and I wondered if it might not prove that more than one soul benefited by the untoward events of the day. With the aid of the astonished and delighted servants, and no little help as well from Signor Valguanera, I fitted up the long altar in the chapel, and by midnight we had the gloomy sanctuary beautiful with flowers and candles. It was a curiously solemn service, in the first hour of the new day, in the midst of blazing candles and their thick incense, the odour of the opening orange blooms drifting up in the fresh morning air, and mingling with the incense smoke and the perfume of flowers within. Many prayers were said that night for the soul of the dead girl, and I think many afterward, for after the benediction, I remained for a little time in my place,
and when I rose from my knees and went toward the chapel door, I saw a figure kneeling still, and with a start recognized the form of the cavalier. I smiled with quiet satisfaction and gratitude, and went away softly, content with the chain of events that now seemed finished. The next day the alcove was again walled up, for the precious dust could not be gathered together for transportation to consecrated ground. So I went down to the little cemetery at Parco for a basket of earth, which we cast in over the ashes of Sister Maddalena. By and by, when Wendell and I went away, with great regret, our Guarnera came down to Palermo with us. The last act that we performed in Sicily was assisting him to order a tablet of marble, whereon was carved this simple inscription. Here lies the body of Rosalia di Castiglione, called Sister Maddalena. Her soul is with him who gave it. To this I added in thought, let him that is without sin among you cast the first stone. For more supernatural crime thrills, find the Lorne Turner series on Audible.